When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Than whole, riddle me that. The rest of y'all know where I'm lurking, yeah. Can't none of y'all mirror me back. Yeah, hear me rap, it's like Angie rapping his prime. I'm young H.O.
Welcome back to Miami Nice. I am your co-host, Blake Howard. Yes, I got my tan here in Miami. My lovely co-host, Katie Walsh, who is a film critic at the Tribune News Service and the LA Times, joins me again. Hello, Katie.
Hi, Blake. Good to see you again. So excited to be here talking about this movie.
It's so good. It's the 15th anniversary of Miami Vice in the last couple of weeks. So we've got an absolute murderer's row lineup of people who are either scrolling through the channels on Nicholas's TV, criticizing how messed up his kitchen is, or staring blankly off into the sublime blue ocean. And one of those people is the person who can say this. This is the only person who can say this on the internet. Their Twitter handle is Miami Vice 2006. It is one of our favorites on all things 1 8 minute production. She's a writer and a film critic at Film School Rejects, and she's just awesome. Anna Swanson, welcome to Miami Nice. It feels like a good time to have you here already.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. This is very exciting. And yeah, this is definitely my kind of my latest very deep dive obsession. but I'm sure we're going to talk more about that. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to being here.
I just need to know I've been dying to ask about the Twitter handle and
so,
how that came about.
So it was kind of like in this period where I was like applying for jobs, and it's weird because it's one of those things where I think being a writer or a critic, you kind of have to have a Twitter presence because it helps you get work in that regard. But it also makes you look a little bit strange when you're applying for jobs in like the normal real world. So yes. I kind of was in this phase where I was like applying for a lot of jobs and trying to not be a red flag on social media in case any recruiters Google me. So I was like, okay, I should not have my full name on Twitter just in case. And then I was kind of like, okay, what if I just like, and I realized the handle was available, and I was, you know, in that sort of phase where I think I had watched the movie like three times in the last month. And I was like, you know what, why not just like use this? I was kind of looking for something, and it just kind of came about. I mean, like, as you know, and as we discussed, I tend to go kind of deep dive into my obsessive movies, and Miami Vice is kind of the movie of the year for me. Even though it's 15 years old, it's my movie of 2021. So it kind of fortuitously came about. It was not with the intention of like being on the show. It just kind of was something where I was like looking for a different Twitter handle so that I could be employable and people would not.
and also for your friends like me, I lost you. And I'm like, where's Anna? I was trying to search you on Twitter. I'm like, where's Anna?
Yeah.
And I'm like, where did she go? And then I immediately saw that it was Miami Vice 2006. And I was like, oh, that's so Anna. That's good. I'm glad that this, I didn't think it was lobbying to be on the show, but guess what? It helps. Anna.
It helps
narrow it down. It works definitely.
Yeah, no, I feel like my running joke for the last like 6 months or so is that you can tell when I've applied to a lot of jobs because my Twitter goes private. Like that's how you can kind of figure out what's going on in my life. But yeah.
15 years, obviously anniversary pieces. Some people begrudge them, but I kind of like, I'm with, I think Matt Zolzaitz wrote a great piece of like, if anniversary pieces are how we get really great and thoughtful criticism and reappraisal or discussion of movies in the past, if that's the way that it happens, who gives a crap? Like let it keep happening and let us like have as many of these pieces. But can I say you would have had this earmarked from like, what, January 1st or December 31st last year that this was coming up and that you were the person that was going to be writing it for Film School Rejects? Is that how it worked?
Yeah, I definitely have like a Google Doc with pitches where I kind of just like, I'm like, oh, okay, 2006. All right, so that's coming up. And then yeah, I probably put this pitch in maybe like a month or two ago, just kind of like getting dibs there, you know? And like, yeah. I totally agree. I think anniversary pieces are great. I think it's a great opportunity to kind of bring up something interesting And, you know, I mean, I think there's a dumb way to do it where it's kind of like, this movie hasn't aged well, and here are all the reasons why. But I think if you actually kind of have some insight about looking at something in retrospect, or, you know, what it meant at the time, I think that can be really great. And I also think it's just for writers, it's a great opportunity to maybe get some eyes on something that you love, where ordinarily, you know, the movies that kind of get attention or get clicks or kind of like the new stuff coming out. And just like in general, I'm just kind of the personality where like, I'd rather just watch and write about the movie from 20 years ago that I love than like have to go see Jungle Cruise opening night in order to like have something to pitch about, you know?
This is what I praise Katie about all the time. I'm like, I'm like, I don't know how you do it. Like I'm stuck in 2007 or like back in 2006 with this. And I'm like, that's where I live, you know, in those times. And I watch her have to review all these movies and I'm like, I admire you.
It's for sure like a skill set that you develop from just doing it day in and day out. But it is interesting talking about anniversary pieces, especially with this movie and the way that it's been reappraised in the past couple of years. Even since we've started doing this podcast, like more and more people are discovering it and appreciating it and talking about it. And like, you know, in my line of work, when it's just like Jungle Cruise, whatever, lame,
Spice
it's like,
Jam.
You know, just like in, out kind of thing. I know. Yeah. I mean, in 15 years, there's going to be somebody writing like critics were too harsh on Space Jam too. I guarantee you. But, you know, I also think it's interesting, like you were saying, you know, instead of doing the, well, this hasn't aged well, or everybody loves this and I hate it. Like my whole vibe right now on Twitter, and maybe it doesn't always come across that way, but I'm like, I'm only doing positive hot takes. Yes. I'm not doing any negative hot takes. Like my hot takes will be like, I love this thing that's dumb or whatever, or, you know, other people have said is dumb. And so I think that I really appreciate when you write it, when someone writes a piece like the one that you wrote, that's like, let's take this thing that everybody gave bad reviews to back in 2006 because they were like salty or tired or had like never seen digital photography look like this before. And let's like unpack what it's actually doing and analyze like how it fits into the realm. And I do think that the way film criticism works, it's like we have so little time to really develop and think about things. And it's usually just like a one viewing and then you have to go write the review. And like, I think that movies require a lot more time and thoughtfulness and effort than just that. But such is the life of the Weekly Film Critic.
Yeah, no, and I've definitely had that of just, you know, kind of looking back on stuff I've written where there's kind of like a time crunch. And I was like, you know what, I probably could have like, you know, had more to say here. I could have gone a little bit more in depth, but I think it's just kind of, it is what it is.
We do what we can.
Yeah.
You do what you can. Not every movie is a minute by minute podcast. Like that's, you know, or a monthly, like constant revisitation to something that we really love. And like, you know, enlisting people like your great self, Anna, who love this movie to kind of like give us their take on it, give us their angle. Because I think you're exactly right. There's so few critics who get the luxury to ruminate. You know, it's hard. Like there's that great Anthony Lane quote is like, I have to write about the movie the day it comes out or 10 years later. And I really, I genuinely really love that because it's like 10 years as a minimum feels like that's a really good way to even decide whether you want to keep talking about the thing, you know, you know, and
I just want to clarify, you're not planning Space Jam 2 minute by minute.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Oh my
not.
God.
Like
you would, that would send you straight into the insane asylum.
No, I literally had to write a review about it. It was one of my rare commissions. I still dabble. I'm very lucky to work with Garth Franklin at Dark Horizons as a sort of a columnist and reviewer now and then. And that was one of my assignments. And I watched it and I was like, oh, Garth, thank you for this. And he was just like, I'm sorry, man. I really want to see what you have to say.
He's and, like, you could do this justice.
And I'm like, this is really one of the meanest pieces of pop culture I've ever seen where they just like Warner Brothers trots out all of the films that they've abandoned or that they're hiding in their vaults or that they've, you know, abused filmmakers and withheld money from things. And they're just going, hey, look what we can do with your IP. That's not what Miami Vice is. No. Miami Vice is a special movie. And I remember walking out and I think what's so, this is about that weekly critic vibe or audience vibe. I remember walking out and Colin Farrell was, he's still like the hot guy in Hollywood, of course, like 20 years later, miraculously. But I remember people at the time being like, I hate his haircut and his mustache. Like that was about the conversation when I walked out, but I love so much reading your stuff and, you know, the digital landscape piece that you did recently for Film School Rejects, Anna. So can, as someone who's ruminating over this film this year and this year, this is your movie, I'd love to talk to you about like how it consumed you. What was the most recent, mm-hmm. not the first time that you watched it, but I really want to get that. I know you've been an Inherent Vice head and a Zodiac head in the past, and that's where both of the times we've spoken to you before, but I really want to know like when did this movie break through and you were like, oh, this is my new thing?
This is actually a good story because it happened this year. So Miami Vice, I wouldn't have seen this in theaters, but like growing up, my mom loves Colin Farrell. She's Irish. So it's kind of, you know, he's part of the family. And like, I love him. Like 7-year-old me thought I was going to marry him. 27-year-old me kind of thinks I might still marry him. You know, like he's the best. I love him. But so I definitely was kind of like aware of Colin Farrell as an actor. And this came out, and I think my mom went to see it and really liked it. So she was ahead of the curve. She was ahead of the critics. And then I think, I don't really remember, but I'm guessing we must have rented it when it came out. And I saw it then and probably didn't really take it in or know what was going on or care about it that much. And then it was kind of one of those things that, you know, maybe a couple times over the years, like, it'd be on Netflix and I just kind of watch it and like, you know, mostly like for Colin Farrell. And, you know, it wasn't my favorite. Like it wasn't kind of my anything that I really thought was that miraculous or that interesting. It was just kind of like a movie to watch. And then a couple of years ago, I want to say like 2019, be the end of 2018, a theater here did a retrospective screening of it. And I saw it on the big screen for the first time. And I was like, you know what? This is kind of better than I think people give it credit for. Like it's always kind of talked about as like, not as good. I think for myself, and I think for a lot of people, Miami Vice and Collateral kind of get lumped in to a very similar time. You know, like they came out within a couple of years of each other. They both sort of have that like digital look. And I think the kind of consensus, or at least what I thought at the time, was, you know, they're kind of similar, but I prefer Collateral. And then I saw it again. I was like, you know what? This actually, like, I kind of like this one. I kind of see what people are saying, you know, the revisionists who are like, actually Miami Vice is great. I'm like, all right, you know what? They have a point. And then I don't know why, but for some reason in January of this year, I think I saw that it was streaming somewhere and I was just like, let's watch this. It's been a couple of years. I remember liking it. Like I got nothing else to do. We're still in the middle of a pandemic. Like I was just kind of like talking to my roommate and I was like, would you mind if I just like put this on? And watching it again, I felt like my third eye opened. Like I was like, this is perfect. And I don't know what clicked for me this time, but it just really, I was like, even though I liked it in the past, I was still kind of underrating it. And I think just, I don't know, maybe after a year of just like watching things at home, like something that I just felt was so enrapturing. I was like, oh, I love this movie. And as I'm wont to do, as we've discussed, you know, when I love something, I want to share it. So naturally at this point, I'm like talking to everyone I know. And I'm like, hey, like, if you watch Miami Vice recently, it's great. And I think for my birthday, actually, I was talking to my boyfriend. I was like, we're going to watch this and you're going to like it. And that was like the plan. And so I think I've watched it now like 5 times this year. It's just kind of one of those things that it's become such a thing for me this year. And I just think it's so brilliant. I feel like I wasted all those years kind of underrating it when I could have been watching it. But
now you get to have this amazing experience of like falling in love with it this year. Wait, I just have one question.
Yeah.
What theater was having a retrospective screening of Miami Vice?
I know.
2019. Is that TIFF?
Yeah. At TIFF, they have their like regular year of retrospective screenings, and it was on 35. And I think it was like, I want to say the winter of 2019, like maybe January, February that year. But they were just like doing a screening, and I definitely like, TIFF is pretty good about retrospective programming. Like they kind of just have stuff running all year and often some really good stuff. So yeah, I saw it and it was just one of those things where I was like, I remember I almost even didn't go because I was like, yeah, like sure, fine, I'll go. And it was just kind of like a thing to do, like, you know, back when you could just go to the movies whenever and you didn't have to worry about COVID. It was just like, yeah, sure, I'll go see this. Why not? Like, and yeah, it was great.
Oh my God. That's so wonderful. And I'm insanely jealous that you saw it on it. But I think that that's like repertory screenings now. Like when I, I tell this story a few times, just like when I left the first, like when COVID first broke, like or a pandemic sort of broke in Sydney for the first time and they opened up a few things. I went to the movies and I saw Predator, 2001 A Space Odyssey, Jaws, and Heat on the big screen. And then I saw Tenet. And people were like, did you like Tenet? I'm like, no. I mean, I'm sorry. It was fine.
I just saw five of the most perfect movies ever made.
I just saw some of my favorite movies of all time on the big screen, and I was complete like on various things. Like Jaws was on 70 mil, and so was 2001 Space Odyssey, and Predator was in the new 4K release, and I was just like, and Heat was the 4K restoration. I'm like, movies are awesome, and Tenet's fine. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, yeah. Like, yeah. And so I'm jealous that you saw Miami Vice. So yeah. Let's dive into, I guess, now. Anyone who listens to Katie and I talk about it, we've probably gone on our own journey in this show about the things that are really resonating with us at the time. And like my current thing that's really resonating with me is just John Ortiz, because I was lucky enough on Zodiac Chronicle to talk to a great character actor in John Carroll Lynch, and he gushed effusively about John Ortiz. He's like, I literally saw John Ortiz in movies and I was like, who the fuck is that guy? He's so good. And he's like, I went to IMDb and I said, John Ortiz, it's John Ortiz, it's John Ortiz, it's John Ortiz. And so I've now, like, my latest viewing of Miami Vice in preparation to talk to you guys is he's been like a John Ortiz just unpacking in my head. So okay, like, where are you at in these five things? What are the things that are really now like your scenes, your moments, the things that are like that, those third eye opening moments for you?
Definitely the boat to Cuba.
My business. And they don't like my passport.
It's okay. The Harbor Method is my cousin.
Like every time I watch the movie, and I don't know what it is. I can't like put it into words exactly what it is, but just like watching that, like there's something about it. I don't know if it's the music, the way it's filmed, just like the fact that it's two of the most beautiful people in the world acting on screen, but it just feels like the world is beautiful and everything is possible and also terribly sad. And I don't know. It's just that scene always gets me. All the stuff in Cuba, the like, you know, do you dance? I dance, all that stuff. Just like, I find their relationship to be such a crux of, I think, what brings me back to this movie. Like just how I just find it so sad every time. It really gets me. And I'm probably going to talk about Colin Farrell a lot, but I just think he's so good in this. And I think what I find so interesting is that I know he said in like interviews since that he kind of didn't love the movie. And like, I think he said that he thought the mustache was a mistake. It's like, Colin, I love you, but that's wrong. Like, absolutely not.
No, justice for the handlebar.
Yeah.
And I think the early days of this podcast, I read a haiku about the handlebar.
I did.
That's amazing. But yeah, and like the hair and stuff. And I think it's so good because it feels so clear that they're not necessarily trying to make him look his best. Mm. And that's kind of what makes him look so good, is that like he has a little bit of that like grunginess to him. I don't know. I think it really works. And I think he's so good in this. And I think he has this like really interesting, ineffable kind of feminine energy to him that like not a lot of actors do. And it's not like something that I can kind of describe, but it just kind of, I don't know. I think it's just in his eyes. He just has these like puppy dog eyes.
Yeah. You know, the thing about he looks grungy, like you can practically smell him.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
It's sweat and his natural musk and some nasty cologne from 2006.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
But it's like the kind of thing that you would like get a whiff of and like, it'd be like instant horny juice. Like the pheromones would go insane.
and we have heard that there
it's like Axe body spray and lime.
it's also the fact that we've actually revealed on the show that we've got some mail from listeners talking about there are paparazzi photos of Colin Farrell at this time partying with Diego Maradona. And it's just like that energy is so chaotic in this guy. But I think you touch on something, Anna, about that scene, because there's two things that happen in my mind as I keep watching this. There's Sonny looking out that window in that apartment with Nicholas and the guys, like looking for something. And we kind of don't know what it is, whether it's meaning, whether it's purpose, whether it's something beyond, whether it's like, you know, in the parlance of Heat, you know, that the action is the juice, whether it's just there's some level of like whether he needs to hit it in this undercover, in his undercover profession that he's just not touching. But then when lightning strikes with Isabella, you kind of, what's so great and unpredictable is you don't know whether it's just that impulse for self-destruction or whether it's genuine and Gong Li
or
is
both
or it's both. Right. And that's the great thing. It could be both. Mm-hmm. And then you get Gong Li who is so glacially perfect that you don't actually believe that she's necessarily doing it for any other reason other than like, oh, there's a play to be made here. Right. As she discusses with Montoya. And what's so great about those Cuba scenes, which I think you're focusing on that boat ride, is there's more than that. There's something happening underneath that's undeniable. Like all their acting, his acting as an undercover cop and the layers of that and maybe going too far, and her acting as like, oh, there's a play in here for me. When you get to that underneath bit, do you dance, I dance, and the starts on the dance floor. As soon as that starts happening, it's like, holy shit, like I don't think either of them have any idea. They have no clue that this was going to mean as much or that they were going to let each other in. And I think that's something that I think about, and I think your piece, and I think you talking to you about it, it starts to like really drum that up for me is there's just something about those two when you put them on screen together that's just, and even in this beautiful Tash N book on Michael Mann, and even in that book, there's the behind the scene photographs he took. I think it's in Haiti where they took the photos that are meant. Oh no, he actually took them in Havana because he snuck them into Cuba and then they shot the film in Haiti. But there's original photographs of just those two in stills. And it's like their hotness and chemistry is just freaking undeniable from minute one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. It's like, I've been thinking a lot about screen chemistry because speaking of Jungle Cruise, I really did not think The Rock and Emily Blunt had chemistry. But then I saw Green Knight and I was like, okay, Dev and Alicia, I ship it. But like it's that, you know, it's like that thing with Gong Li and Colin where you're like, there's this urgency and this tension that you're just like, it kind of drives you mad as a viewer. But yeah, their chemistry is undeniable. I have a question for my man experts. Mm. So like all these Michael Mann heroes are constantly sort of like dreaming of tropical paradises, right? Mm. Like Jamie Foxx and Collateral, and isn't Neil also sort of like dreaming of some like island? Is he?
Yeah, he's talking about iridescent algae in Fiji and traveling to New Zealand. Yeah, there's a lot of escapes that are
right. There's like this constant dream of like water, like looking out at water, like dreaming of this escape, and it's like Sonny's like the only one that kind of achieves that. for a brief moment in time.
Yeah, there's the actual tactile experience of that island hopping paradise. Yeah, absolutely. You're right. You're
like,
spot on.
I'm just wondering if he's the only Michael Mann hero who like actually sort of like touches that in a way. And the sadness is like, I think that moment like where they're in the house on the beach, like I think I've said this before on the podcast, like it really feels like a real relationship getaway that you would have, like a sexy weekend getaway, and it feels palpable and real. And so there's something about the fact that it goes away or it doesn't last that's like part of the tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now that you mention that, I never would have thought to connect these things, but I think Manhunter a little bit, there's kind of the idea that Will kind of gets his beach house and he gets out and then he's pulled back in. And so yes. I think he kind of gets that, but I think there's this idea that there's always going to be something pulling him back into the job. And, you know, when he ends on the beach with his family and the driftwood and all of that, that's not lasting. That's never going to be there forever. There's always going to be something. And I think same here, you know, it's like that brief getaway. And I think even it's interesting that it's Cuba, where he kind of says, you know, Cubans don't like my passport. Like, I'm not supposed to be here, like in a very concrete material way. He understands that this space is not for him.
Yeah, and it's you know, forbidden, of course, on like many levels.
Yeah,
it's
and,
like,
yeah, and it can be as, yeah, it can be as explicit. Yeah, it can be as explicit as they don't like my passport, but it's also like they don't like your identity, man. Like you don't. You're like this is a fake Sonny Crockett that's sitting here. You know, this is not real. Or it's as real as he's ever going to be with
you're
someone else.
You're not made for this space.
But
yeah.
You're not made for here. Yeah, no, and I love what you said about Will Graham, because it's like literally as soon as, you know, the fatalism of Will Graham, like, not getting that island space to keep his relaxation is seeing Dennis Farina in a suit. Like, you see Farina in that suit straight away and you're like, something's wrong. You're just on the piece of wood. It's like, he's being dragged back. Like, he's going to get the rake. He's going to get the rake right out of there. But yeah, no, it's so fascinating that little sequence, and just everything about it just completely just turns it on its head beautifully.
One thing I love about your piece, Anna, is the way you talk about the digital photography and like how it captures movement, and that it's not something that you can easily sort of like screenshot and be like, look at this perfect composition or whatever, you know, one perfect shot. And like, I love that because I hadn't thought about that before. And I think one of the things that draws me into this film, obviously, is like the vibe. And it's like, how do you describe the vibe? And for me, it's like, it's obviously looks cool, but there's also like this roiling danger underneath kind of going on. And I think that the way that you describe some of the digital photography and the way that works sort of illuminated that for me when I was reading your piece.
Yeah, no, that's so nice for you to say. But yeah, I think definitely like being at Film School Rejects and kind of being tied to one perfect shot. I'm kind of always on the lookout when I watch new movies, just thinking, you know, could that be like a good shot? And I think it's interesting how when you talk about cinematography, everyone kind of has a little bit of a different idea of what makes something good or perfect, quote unquote. And I think, you know, it could be just a still image that is very beautiful. And that's sort of like every frame of painting type idea, where it's just like, you have this shot that you can screen save and print it out and put it on your wall and it'll look beautiful. And like, that to me is like a movie like Assassination of Jesse James, where like there are shots in that movie where I'm just like, I'll put this on my wall happily. And, you know, and then there are other movies, and I think, you know, one is not better or worse than the other, but then there's something like this where I don't really know how to grab a screenshot of this. I don't know how to take a singular image from Miami Vice because it just doesn't work. You can't get a single screenshot of it that looks good. And it's so tough to kind of explain to people, because I'm like, I want to be able to sort of like have that. And I think, you know, something like Thief, for example, I think has some lovely sort of imagery.
Thief's got
where
like
you're just
30 stills where it's like, here's a composition, people looking out at the water, like Frank appraising what we're in the middle of the heist, you know, that sensational night shot that I feel like has been Priscilla Page's banner for like 10 years.
Yeah,
of like
the car dealership.
The car dealership with the neon, you know, that great stuff. But no, it's so funny because I actually recently just watched LA Confidential as well, which is, you know, Dante Spinotti. So one of our man guys is the cinematographer and Curtis Hanson's the director. And there are some like amazing still shots that happen in there, but Curtis Hanson's impulse, there are so many like, the camera's always pushing in. It's like creating these compositions, but then it like pushes in. And I was just thinking that same thing when I was watching something like LA Confidential. It has these stills, but then there's other shots of like Lynn Bracken and Bud. So like, you know, Kim Basinger and Russell Crowe like kissing, and like every shot is like a push in or it's like sweeping in. I'm like, this is actually hard to go, where would you do the shot? Do you do it at the beginning or do you do it at the end where you like got this intimacy? And I feel like that's like that weird kind of tactile sort of intimate swirling cameras around that this movie does and like constant pace. I even think on the top of, other than that, you know, that streaming, you know, bullet-like boat shot from that's happening in the sky, I think about that other shot, series of shots where they're all in the boat debriefing about how they're going to do this next take, and it goes like, it's Fox, it's like Elizabeth Rodriguez, it's Justin Theroux, then it's back to Farrell. Like, the camera is, like, firing around at that setup, and it's hard to orient yourself and ever go, oh, then no, here's a perfect shot of Jamie Foxx in the water, you know, because it's just so dynamic.
Yeah, there's a great shot of like the plane going through the sky.
I love that shot. Yeah.
Yes.
And like, what, do I take a screenshot of that? It just looks like a plane. Like, it's not special until you see it in movement. Yeah. And then when you see the fluidity of it, it's like, oh my God, this is beautiful. But like, you can't kind of boil that down into one image, which is, I mean, again, like, I don't think it's necessarily better or worse than movies where you kind of have those like clean shots that you can kind of say this singular thing is a beautiful example of cinematography. But I think in a lot of ways, it's so indicative of kind of man's approach in recent years of just, this is such a singularly cinematic thing where it can't exist as a still image. It just can't. And I think that's tough. And I think that kind of is difficult to kind of, you know, put that next to a lot of ideas of what makes cinematography good. And I think especially, you know, when you discuss it, you can't really like have movements. You can't show a whole movie if you want to show someone what makes good cinematography. Often, like, you look up, you know, examples of good cinematography, you're going to see like a still image. And I don't know, it's tough. It's a very thorny thing. But anyway, the point is, I think this movie is beautiful.
Yeah, I think it's a good example. Like, this conversation is a good example of like illustrating, like, cinematography is not just creating perfect compositions. Like,
the future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The thing that was drilled into me in undergrad was like, the style of the film like has to serve the story that you're telling. And I think that this is just such a good example of that, because we're in 2006 Miami, we're going undercover, we're using little cell phones, we're taking videos, we're surveilling people. Like, it should have that kind of grimy lo-fi you know, vibe to it. Like, it shouldn't, like, at night, it should be kind of like dark and sketchy looking. Like, I think it fits the themes of the film really well. And the other thing I was going to say about, like, I am always looking for stills of this movie or like gifts to promote the show or like reply to people with or something. There's like no gifts of this movie. And it might be because it's like not popular enough to like have a lot of people making gifts of it. But I'm like, I don't want to use the same gif every time. I want a different one. I was even looking for a picture of Dominic Lombardozzi yesterday, and I couldn't find any good ones.
I know, there's not. I think that might have to be part of the show. I think we're gonna have to. I'm gonna have to learn how to make gifts and and turn this whole show into this whole film into gifts, because it's driving me insane.
Outsource it to someone.
Yeah. Someone listening, please get in touch. mail@oneheatminute.com for Katie and I. If you know how to make rad gifts, please get in touch, because we need your help.
Like,
I'm gonna get Meg to do this.
Oh, Meg Shields, bless her heart. She's the best. But I wanted to talk to you guys about something really quick because it just reminded me is a brief digression on Manhunter. So there was a recent rewatchables on Manhunter with the guys at The Ringer, and then Quentin Tarantino popped up, as he occasionally does, to do another rewatchables podcast, which is great. Him popping in on the show to have a chat, I think it was around the release of the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood book, and he smashed Bill Simmons's hot take that Will Graham was miscast, William Peterson being, he was just like, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. William Peterson struggled to get out of that because all filmmakers and people watched him in that movie Manhunter, and you know, did the double feature basically of To Live and Die in LA, and Manhunter back to back, and almost couldn't get out of it, and so was actually lured back eventually into CSI and the new CSI as well, to play that kind of like investigative, you know, intuitive, empathetic character. And I think that Manhunter is such an incredibly influential film that influenced a whole bunch of other genres all the way up into all sorts of crime genre films. And I also feel like Miami Vice is an equivalent in that at the time, the critical praise was very tempered, and then it took a little while, and you know, some people like the incredible Manola Dargis and stuff like that to put it on their year-end lists and things like that, to people go, wait, is this actually a thing? And now it's coming around. But I think this, I feel like I see the techniques of Miami Vice in so many contemporary films and shows. And even as recent as there's a great Amazon Prime series called 000 with a one of the executive producers is a director called Stefan Solima, who is an Italian director who's directed that Without Remorse with Michael B. Jordan things like that. And he did the second Sicario. But I see those movies and I'm like, I see Miami Vice techniques or like stylistic kind of flourishes, and I'm like, even if critics didn't like it at the time and it took a while for fans to warm up, I feel like directors and filmmakers at the time were like, shit, that's awesome, and I'm gonna do that so many times. So I was just wondering, Anna, because I know that you and all, the whole gang at Film School Rejects are so like, you know, such cinephiles, but like, is there movies that after you've now had that third eye open to Miami Vice that you're like, you feel like Miami Vice fingerprints are on it in your recent watching?
That is such a good question. I'm trying to think.
Sorry to spring this on you, but Manhunter and Miami Vice.
Yeah. I mean, I think definitely I see a lot with Miami Vice and Manhunter, which I think coincidentally are like my two favorite mans. So, you know, definitely there's a lot there. Also just speaking of William Peterson, it's just wild to me the idea that like giving great performances in two of the best movies of all time can hurt your career. Like what is wrong with the world? God, I see, it's tough because like, I'm sure there are, but now that I'm like on the spot, I can't think of any. And I'm also probably like in my mind, I'm like, well, they're not as good as Miami Vice. So they don't matter. But no, I think definitely, I think that there's, I think in a lot of ways, I want to say, I wish there was more like that, because I think what I find so interesting about Miami Vice, and I kind of wrote about this, but it's digital, but it's not trying to look like film. And I think that so many movies kind of do digital and try to look like film, which is fine. There's a lot of great movies that do that. That's, you know, do your thing. But I wish there was a little bit more of an interest in movies that use digital and don't try to replicate that look, or don't try to fit into this kind of binary idea of like what makes a film look good, which again kind of I think goes into the idea of like what makes cinematography good. Like, you know, so many beautiful shots in the film, if you try and boil them down to one thing, or you try and make them, I mean, if this movie had tried to look like film, I don't think it would be what it is.
No, I agree.
But yeah, I'm trying to think. I'm sure the second we stop recording this, a perfect example is going to spring to my mind, and I'm going to be like, oh, this.
Well, if it happens, Anna, we can quickly call, and we'll just make a pause right now. we'll chop it in very artfully and edit it in.
Are there any you have in mind?
It's more of like an approach. Because Miami Vice was one of the first times that I ever saw the idea of truly international criminal operations that work seamlessly across borders.
Yeah.
And I feel like since then I've heard the phrase Aryan Brotherhood and like international drug shipping in like 30 movies. But I remember seeing Miami Vice and being like, oh, crime's not just like mafia that stop locally or domestically. It is about an international network that relies on bribing multiple government agencies, multiple police agencies, and the whole concept that like inherently through crime. And I see it even on like a micro scale in something like recently No Sudden Move with Soderbergh's movie, about this whole idea that there are huge corporate entities that have an interest in low-level crime because it gives them money. And if they lose money, they're going to make it back. And that people that do their slights will just die. And it's a kind of a cynical, almost like Sidney Lumet, like network level of like cynicism of like corporate crime and things like that happened so long ago. But it feels like man here is bridging the gaps between those thoughts of like, no, it's an international criminal conspiracy and things like that. And a lot of people have since said with like both Blackadder and Miami Vice, you know, there was a great book that actually came out under the Michael Mann Books banner called like Hunting LaRue, which is about a real hacker figure that was hiring mercenaries to run guns internationally, was maybe going to be a movie.
I listened to that book.
It's a great book. It's a great book. And it feels like a Michael Mann movie that you listen to or you read. It's amazing. But they were just like, oh, you know, did you hear about LaRue and use some elements when you were making Miami Vice and when you were making Black Hat? And it was like, no, we were just doing research and hearing about these figures who are like hacking things, counterintelligence. So for me, that language, and I could totally be proven wrong. I'm happy for you guys to email us if there are other examples, but I feel like the way that Michael Mann did it in Miami Vice has then since permeated. Like you can't have a cool criminal conspiracy unless it's a international conspiracy with kingpins that operate in, you know, these shadow countries and moving money offshore and, you know, satellite technology. There's too many to count for me probably.
Yeah, I think you're kind of totally correct. And I always think this movie feels so modern in its storyline and in its storytelling for being so grounded in what feels like really real details. I mean, even like the drug cartel stuff, like Sicario, both of the Sicario movies, like just all that stuff. I don't feel like the movies in 2006 were really talking about criminal organizations, like international criminal organizations, like you said.
Yeah.
But like, obviously Mann is such a detail oriented filmmaker and such a research oriented filmmaker that obviously he was going to be like, I know everything about how these cartels work. And it's an interesting contrast to the show, which there was a great thread on Twitter today where someone did all these guest stars from the Miami Vice show. Did you see that?
Yeah. Yeah. I started looking at it a little bit earlier, but
it's
so long. Yeah.
But it's hilarious. But it's like John Turturro played a pimp and like Willie Nelson played a, you know, whatever, a bad guy, but it's like very cartoonish. And like, you know, obviously within the frame of an episodic show, it's like, oh, pash pow, we're going to get the bad guy today. And then, you know, and then they all go have a mojito or whatever it is they do. I actually haven't really watched the TV show at all, but that's what it seems like to me. Like, it's like we catch the bad guy every week, but this is like turning it, you know, even the Aryan Brotherhood, tying those guys in, like the informants, like it all feels really grounded and real. And I think that films after that, after this, like started going for that, especially in that like 2007 era, like mid-2000s, started going for that kind of like real gritty kind of like based in reality type of stuff. And I would also say you mentioned Without Remorse and like instantly I was like totally influenced by Miami Vice. I didn't love Without Remorse, but like definitely some of the action kind of close up like felt like kind of influenced for sure.
Yeah. A cool action, great directed action movie, not a great movie, but the action rips. Like the action's really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of not the same thing, but kind of one thing that I was thinking about when you were mentioning kind of the way that, you know, even crime has changed. I feel like there was, you know, it's not the, you know, cops and robbers, everything is kind of localized. But one thing I did kind of watch last year for the first time was The Sopranos. And just the way you're talking about that makes me think of the episode where they kind of go to go to the new coffee shop, and it's like, I don't know if it's like literally a Starbucks, but it's like a Starbucks.
Yeah.
And they're kind of like, all right, like you're gonna pay us for protection, and they're like, and the manager's like,
I don't have any discretionary funds. It's gotta go through corporate.
But how do you think corporate would feel if, for the sake of argument, someone threw a brick through your window?
They've got like 10,000 stores in North America. I don't think they fill anything.
What if, God forbid, it wasn't just vandalism? What if an employee, even the manager, say, was assaulted?
Look, every last fucking coffee bean is in the computer and has to be accounted for. If the numbers don't add up, I'll be gone and somebody else will be here.
And like, if you know, whatever you do, like, I'm sorry, this is not like a mom and pop place where you just skim a few hundred out off the register and it goes to the mobsters. It's like everything is so corporate now. And I think, I mean, that's kind of that episode probably aired pre Miami Vice even, but I think kind of that idea is still there. I'm just like, this is not like crime happening on the same block. It's like everything is kind of corporate or international.
Yeah, I know. It's, and the way that, that, you know, they're kind of touching on it in Miami Vice, but like cell phones and internet and communication and the way it just like makes a global crime syndicate work is because of like cellular technology and digital technology. And so, yeah.
Even I think the idea of like, you know, kind of these traditional aspects of crime where it's like, we're going to kidnap someone and hold them for ransom and you're going to do what we say. And then we're going to let them go and kind of like a certain amount of, I almost want to say like respectability in that. And now it's kind of like, do what we say or we kill her, but we're going to kill her anyway.
Yeah.
Like it's just, I don't know. There's something like especially brutal about that kind. Cause it's like, you know, you had a deal.
Yeah.
They didn't stick to the deal. They're criminals, but they're supposed to stick to a deal. And, you know, I think even that kind of idea of like, that heat thing of, you know, we're not criminals so different, you and I. And like, yeah, there's a code. There's no code anymore.
No, and I think that's you just nailed it absolutely. And another movie that I think about, which is also much maligned, I feel like it's an Anna Swanson movie of the future, is Ridley Scott's The Counselor. But it's that kind of movie where, like, when you're dealing with international cartels and you're just one individual who's getting in their way, they don't care if they kill you. Like, that would just kill, like, if you do something wrong with it, they'll just kill you. Or they'll take,
that's,
you know,
one that I've actually been in the mood to rewatch lately. I didn't love The Counselor when I first saw it, but I've kind of been in the feeling lately that like maybe I needed to give it another shot.
A particular reason that I could see, she slices off her knickers and hands them to me and gets out of the car. I asked her what she was doing and she says, I'm going to fuck your car. All right.
With the door open.
So, she goes around and climbs up on the hood of the Ferrari and pulls her dress up around her waist and spreads herself across the windshield in front of me with no panties on. And she's had this Brazilian wax job. Huh? Don't even think I'm making this up. You can't make this up, right? I mean, she was a dancer. So, she does this full split, and then she starts rubbing herself up and down on the glass. Then she leans down to see if I'm watching. Like, no, I'm sitting there reading my email. And kisses me upside down. And then she tells me that she's gonna come. And I thought, well, I'm losing my fucking mind. That's what's happening here. You know, it was like one of those catfish things, you know? One of those bottom feeders you see going up the side of the aquarium, sucking its way up the glass. I mean, it was, I don't know, hallucinatory. You see a thing like that, it changes you.
But that idea of there's no code. Tell me about it. And I think also we talk a lot about throwback crime. You know, I think in the discourse is like, oh, it's so hard to do a movie in the digital age because of XYZ. And it feels like Miami Vice is just like, nah. Like it just goes, no, of course, like we've got cell phones, we've got cell phone cameras, we're gonna hack into, you know, or people are gonna have cameras that are like at remote locations so they can see what's happening in different spaces. And, you know, Jose Euro with the whole like, I can see what's happening in the trailer and I'm gonna explode the bomb, or like he doesn't realize that they've infiltrated, and as soon as he types into the right camera in this, what you imagine is like this whole network of safe houses that he has really gnarly bad shit going on at, he can just like dial a number on his keyboard and there's the camera of Trudy being released from capture, and then he can execute that bomb that blows the whole trailer to smithereens. And I feel like this movie completely embraces that. Like it has to be cell phones, has to be email. There is global tracking. There's all this stuff, and it's like you just have to have people who run the counterintelligence that are undermining that sort of thing. And I even see that later with like, you know, probably the best Bond movie in the whole franchise being Skyfall, of like having to, your ability to counter intelligence is never to carry your cell phone. It's to carry a radio and a gun that has no tracking, so that's all you can have. Like if you disengage with technology, I feel like this movie plays that game really well of like, we have to manipulate, we have to do counter intelligence, and then that influences varieties of that later. And I think that's how you do it. It's like, you know, it's always counterintelligence, which is such a fun phrase, and I feel like that's popularized so hard in this movie.
We don't need to do it now, but at some point we're going to need to come back to that claim about Skyfall that is not correct.
It's good.
Okay. It's not the best.
Okay, I said counterintelligence on the best Bond.
Yeah. What's the best Bond movie? Is it Casino Royale?
See, it sounds like such a cliche to say it's Casino Royale, but I really do think it is.
Yeah, look at
it. Like, I don't know. Like, Skyfall's top 10, I guess. Like,
I guess.
It's no Honor Majesties. It's no GoldenEye. Like, you know, it's fine.
Look, this is a conversation for another time.
It's not even the second best Craig, in my opinion.
Oh my God. Okay. No.
Fighting words.
They're fighting words.
This is kind of going back to what, Katie, what you were saying about like only positive hot takes. You know what? I'm not going to talk about Skyfall. I'm going to talk about how Quantum is seriously underrated. Okay.
That's a third eye movie. I just see the fingerprints, right? Like, and James Bond as a franchise is a sponge of like anything that's happening in pop culture. Like anything that's happening in pop culture, if it's like Star Wars, it's got to make Moonraker.
Parkour.
I was going to say parkour.
anything cool that happens will be in a James Bond movie 2 years later.
They're like, oh, poker's like big. We need to like do the movie about you know, Texas Hold'em.
Yeah.
It's such a funny thing, but yeah, it's such a sponge. But that's what I'm finding. The more research that I do on Mann as a fan of his work and like people that are influenced by him, and even just really influential directors like Fincher, for example, you know, whatever the public reaction is to their work is often immaterial, because it seems like regardless of what public opinion is, the people who are doing the craft and filmmakers themselves are so impressed and enamored by the techniques that are used that they then co-opt them into their own style. And then later on, you see these films where you're like
bleeds into the culture.
Yeah. Bleeds into the culture from other people using similar techniques. Yeah. From the creators. And then so later it's like, oh no, I loved X. And people are like, oh, I didn't like Panic Room. And then like people later are like, I love Panic Room. You know what I mean? And they're filmmakers. And so they're then taking some of those techniques of their own films. And you're like, oh, okay, well, everyone loves it, I guess. Yeah. You know, it's a really funny thing.
I think what you were saying about all the digital stuff within a crime movie, I mean, obviously, I think that Mann in this past decade, like obviously he's interested in new technologies, whether it's filmmaking techniques or digital cinematography or how it functions within the story, like Black Hat and having this film. I mean, Black Hat has so many shots of servers. I was like, it was driving me insane. I was like, I can't. And obviously that movie has not been reappraised in the same way that Miami Vice has, although it's probably coming.
I think it's coming. I think Black Hat rules.
People are really trying. And look.
Yeah. Anna's on the forefront. She is fighting.
No, I really.
And so is Bilga, I think.
A friend of the shows that you guys have probably heard, and I know Katie's spoken to, like Stu Coot, who's a big part of the shows. Stu says a funny line sometimes. He's like, you know, I don't want to kink shame you. I don't want to yuck your yum, he says. I don't want to yuck your yum. And for all those people out there who really dig Black Hat, like, great. I'm so happy. The only problem you're ever going to have with me is some people who start going, Black Hat's Michael Mann's best film. And I just and then you just need to go, you need to really stop and have a shower and have a rest, because something's wrong. Okay.
You're like, have a glass of water and think about what you just said.
Because, and that's my only challenge ever, is when you start saying that, it's like, then you've got to put it against Heat, and you've got to put it against The Insider, which I think in my mind, Heat and The Insider are two absolutely sublimely perfect movies. And at a time in my life, In some respects, it's indistinguishable between, like, Heat was always my favorite, but like The Insider is so close that it's like, I say it's like a Tom Noonan hair away, because it's Tom Noonan's hair is so thin from Manhunter. It's like, it's like that thin between those two perfect movies. But then also you've then got to contend with Miami Vice, which we, of course, the three of us love, and people listening love that movie.
I love Thief, Collateral.
Thief, Collateral. Yeah. I'm wearing.
Manhunter is my number one.
I'm going to show you guys. I'm wearing a Collateral t-shirt. That's the IKEA poster, and it says,
that is great.
Tom Cruise on it, and it says, "Yo, homie, that my briefcase on top with a yellow cat." Okay, this is the coolest t-shirt.
I love that shirt.
I'm sending you both the link afterwards where
yes,
I bought it.
So thank you.
And I'll even put it in the description on the show notes for people to find, because it's the coolest thing ever. But then you've got this amazing crop of, like, we've done Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans. You got Last of the Mohicans, if that's your kind of jam. Manhunter. Yeah. I've been rewatching it recently with the Criterion neo-noir section. It's such a stunning movie.
Yeah.
You know, then you've got
The Keep.
And Meg Shields, my favorite person to talk to The Keep about. The Keep, a wild and weird movie, but like that's in that next tier. And I just think that Michael Mann is such an amazing filmmaker for such a, what is ultimately like a kind of short-ish filmography.
Yeah.
It's so hard for people, like it's so hard for me to be like, you really think the one with, in my mind, Chris Hemsworth as in his most charmless performance,
he's not good.
Doing the worst accent of all time. Like like even just at a foundational level, you fix that movie by at least like a star if you say, make him an Australian hacker. It's an international movie.
Yeah.
Let him be charming. Can anyone let Chris Hemsworth be charming, please? And then they found out how to do it. You know, they did it with the Thor Ragnarok, was like his like peak charm. And they're like, that funny, charming Australian accent. And you know,
actually really good in Ghostbusters.
Oh,
yeah, he's great
fun
in that. He's great when he gets to be funny.
Hemsworth's
early accent work, I just need to touch down on this a little bit. In Black Hat, he is taking me, in a single sentence, he is taking me from Boston to Brooklyn to Chicago.
Yeah.
He is taking me all over the United States in a single sentence. And I'm just
that's the world. It's so international. But crime is all over the place. And so is the accent.
But no,
studied like Mike Ditka and the Affleck brothers for his accent work. And I'm like, what are you doing? Like, why is this happening? Every word is changing.
But
anyway, this is my little bugaboo. Chris Hemsworth accent and Black Hat.
I think you're spot on, because I would have loved, and what I actually think, and this is, you know, you never want to correct your great creative people, but I feel like if you had something and go, hey, make him Australian, because it's really on brand to have an Australian that is, the Americans capture and Australia as a government bends over to let him be imprisoned in America and doesn't extradite him back to Australia for a crime.
Right.
And I'm just like, that actually is like a really rad storyline. An Australian guy goes to MIT, gets in prison for hacking, and he's just an Aussie guy in there. And I think if you did that, the movie's a star better for me instantaneously. Because people, and this is where I like marvel at Eric Banner, because Eric Banner's parents are Eastern European, and they migrated to Australia, and he's got an Aussie as accent if you hear him talk normally, if you've seen the recent great movie The Dry. But his first performance was as Chopper. And so, you know, that, you know, real ochre, you know, unabashed Australian. And then, like, his best movie in my mind, even better than Chopper, is Munich, Steven Spielberg's Munich. Mm. And he spent 11 months.
Are we going to bring up Troy? Are we going to talk about Troy?
His pecs are outstanding in Troy. His pecs are outlandishly great.
I'm sure you're right that like his best movie is Munich, and I know like in an objective sense that's correct. But like to me, it's just like Prince Hector. Like I love Troy. That's who he is to me. But I love him. He's great.
He's so great. But I just mean, as far as the accent work goes, mm-hmm. like the accent work that he's able to do there, I just feel like Chris Hemsworth didn't get 11 months to prepare and nail an accent. he just kind of, it's this awful accent. It doesn't work. And
he needs to be locked in a room with Eric Bana, Tony Collette, and Kate Blanchett. And they're all just going to do like a boot camp with him.
Tony Collette is
not
just,
even Nicole is invited. Nicole.
Sorry, Nicole. No, Nicole can only go if she's dressed like she is in The Paperboy. That's when she's allowed to be in that same room. That's the accent work in The Paperboy is outstanding. But no, I just, you know, that I think That's where I start to get a bit funny about the whole Black Hat reappraisal. It's like, you can like it as much as you like, but if you, the minute you say that it's better than Heat or The Insider, you need to lay down. You need to see someone.
You need to lay down.
That's fair.
Yeah.
But I don't think I think the thing is that I don't think it's like as bad as some people might claim it to be, you know?
No.
Interesting to see like if it'll become more like, you know, he's pushing the form and he's pushing like the storytelling in terms of, you know, technology and stuff. So I'm like, maybe No Time to Die will be about like hackers or something.
Yeah. I think that there's a lot of that. I think there's a lot of that going on. And there's actually, and this is the other great Michael Mann thing. And, you know, we talk about a lot with Miami Vice of like theatrical cut, the director's cut, an upcoming Miami Nice cut of the film that we're working on with an editor friend of ours, sort of is a blend of the director's cut and the theatrical cut. But we're just calling it the Miami Nice cut. So we'll a nice tease for anyone who's listening. There will be a future live stream event where you'll get to watch the Miami Nice cut with Katie and I. So please keep an ear out on the show for that, coming soon. But
that's awesome.
Yeah. We're really excited about it. But it's just one of those things where we always talk about it, and like even there's actually a Black Hat version that I think you guys can access in the States and Canada on FX. That's a director's cut, not the one that you can see as a theatrical. And the director's cut is actually much better, in my opinion. So it's like,
that's the only version of it I've seen. So when I say that I like Black Hat, I mean that I like the director's cut version that I've seen that we're not going to mention specifically how I accessed, but you know, that's the version that I've seen. If anyone would like to give me Michael Mann's address, I'll send him $10 for that. You know what I mean? Like, I'll support him.
Yeah. Can someone at one of our DVD label friends just hurry up and bring out a double edition of Black Hat that's got both versions on it, please. Thank you very much.
Let me buy like a Blu-ray of the director's cut and I'll happily pay full price. But yeah, I think the thing with Miami Vice is kind of the theatrical to me is Miami Vice, you know, like we need that opening.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. We need that opening. We need it. I saw someone did a question on Twitter, like, oh, should I watch the director's cut? And everyone was like, theatrical.
Yeah, I think,
the numb on four. Like that must open your third eye first.
Yeah.
Not watch the boat race.
and I think that in the theater, Anna, that's why I was like, I'm so jelly of that screening, is like in the theater when the lights go down and it's just
like
bang.
That smash cut and it's just smash woo, cut. And it's like, here we go.
Yeah. Like it's so appetizing to do. But look, Anna, this has been an absolute blast talking to you. Thank you for the lovely digressions. Thank you for the goading of getting into a Daniel Craig fight in the middle of the show. And thanks for your beautiful insights on the digital photography, because I think it's such a cool topic that we haven't had to smash through as much on the show yet. But I'm excited. I was excited to talk to you about it because of, you know, everyone at Film School Rejects, you guys in One Perfect Shot have got that like mindset of it. That some films in their perfect shotness require the movement of cinema. Like it can't just be a photographic composition. It has to embrace movement. Like Katie said, if you do a screenshot of a plane, it's just a stupid plane. It doesn't actually work. But look, thank you so much for being a part of the show. And where can people find you other than at Miami Vice 2006 on Twitter?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Like you said, I'm on Twitter. I'm at Film School Rejects a lot. If you're in Toronto, you can find me sometimes at the Globe and Mail. I'm around. I'll be covering TIFF this year for Film School Rejects. So awesome. I'll be seeing Titane and probably some other stuff, but that's what's on my radar.
Lucky you.
Yeah. I got some stuff to look forward to. But yeah, I'll be around, you know, yelling about James Bond and Colin Farrell anytime you want to find me.
This was so fun, Anna. I love talking to you. And your piece is so great. And everyone go find it. It's called Navigating the Digital Landscape of Michael Mann's Miami Vice on Film School Rejects. This was great.
That's so nice of you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. And
we will make sure it's linked in our show notes too.
Yeah, we'll
link it in the show notes. We'll link to Anna's Miami Vice 2006. You can guarantee there's some good chat there. And we will try when we eventually do our... great Miami Nice screening, we'll try and get Anna along to watch the Miami Nice cut on a live stream with us as well.
Can't wait.
See you guys.
Thank you guys so much.
Bye.
Oh,
Hi, this is Blake Howard, host and producer of One Heat Minute Productions podcast. We dive into the great and underappreciated cinematic works, often 1 minute or one scene at a time. Our crew of guests are some of the most wonderful filmmakers, writers, authors, and critics ever assembled. Our shows include One Heat Minute, Josie and the Podcats, All the President's Minutes, Increment Vice, and right now, Zodiac Chronicle. Check out oneheatminute.com or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.